The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Washington Post and, time permitting, National Geographic. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. No matter how well planned, a trip does not always turn out as expected, right? Well, in some cases, yes, it can be a disaster. Take the cases of seven travel writers who shared their stories about blunders on the road with the Washington Post. Their articles, Don't Make These Travel Mistakes, appeared in the August 21st, 2020 issue of the Post. And preceding these articles is a short introduction by the Post editors. They write, "That sinking feeling, it's as much a part of travel as returning your tray table to the upright locked position. We explore unfamiliar cities, revel in foreign cultures, and savor the beauty of faraway places. But we also let our passports expire, lock ourselves out of our hotel rooms, and miss our connecting flights. Experienced travelers are no exception. They can't believe this is happening to them. But it is. Turns out rookie mistakes aren't just for rookies. Though it's not much consolation when you've just checked into the worst hotel in town or you find yourself on an eastbound train when you were headed west, mishaps can make us better, stronger, and nimbler travelers. From bad times, they say, come good stories, and, if we're lucky, a little wisdom as well. With that in mind, we asked a group of seasoned travel writers to own up to their less-than-stellar moments on the road. Here's what they had to say. We begin with writer Dina Mischeff, and her article is titled Dangerous Links. My last night in Budapest was dedicated to sausage shopping. My then-husband was hard to shop for and in a serious meat phase at the time. Sausages were the best gift I could come up with. This should have clued me in that the marriage was doomed. Other family and friends were getting paprika, porcelain, and Tokaji wine. It took 5 minutes at a food market to fill my messenger bag with different styles of sausages seasoned with different spices. Hungarian sausages are heavier than you'd think, and the walk back to the hotel was hard, especially since it was early December, and Budapest streets and sidewalks were icy, and the divinely distracting smell of karaskalax, that cinnamon-covered dough cooked over a spit and popular during the Christmas season, haunted nearly every street corner. Salivating in the direction of one of these spits, rather than paying attention to my footing, I slipped and fell on a patch of ice, landing squarely on the messenger bag. I hoped the crack I heard was the ice or a sausage. It was not. Every breath I took felt like a sharp stab. Laughing felt like shards of glass exploding in my back. I know this because I spent much of the flight home wondering if I was the first person in the world to have broken her ribs on sausages. I've always had a tendency toward awkwardness, but this was a new level. An hour into the transatlantic flight home, in the middle seat in economy, though, the great sausage attack of 2010 had ceased to be funny. Back on U.S. soil, I shuffled slowly through customs, stopping only when a dog started sniffing at my cart. The paprika I bought home for Aunt Elaine was quite pungent. If they take Aunt Elaine's paprika, I'm going to scream. I wish they had taken Aunt Elaine's paprika. The last I saw of my sausages was a customs officer carrying them off to join a pile of meat products confiscated from other travelers, as clueless as I was about what foods could be brought into the country. I called a warning to the retreating officer. Be careful. Those sausages are more dangerous than they look. And then we head on to Mother's Helper, written by travel writer John Briley. My plan seemed flawless. Fly to Chicago to join my in-laws for Thanksgiving 2018, then cut out pre-dawn Friday for a flight to the Bahamas for a 4-day dive trip, allowing me to check the family holiday and self-indulgent travel boxes without vaporizing too many vacation days. But on Thanksgiving morning, as I rearranged dive gear in my suitcase, I stopped cold. I'd left my passport at home in Tacoma Park. As my heart sank, a microscopic version of me tore through the clutter of my mind, overturning every action of the prior 3 days in the faint hope that, just maybe, I'd slip the passport into my luggage. Nothing. Next thought, I was flying through Miami where I'd meet my friend Bill, who was coming from D.C. Could he bring my passport so I'd have it for the international leg of the trip? No, said American Airlines, you can't check in at O'Hare International Airport without that hollowed document. Could I fly back through D.C. instead? Sure, for an additional $1,000. I finally landed at age 52, where I should have started. I called my mom, who raced 3 miles from her house to mine, grabbed the passport, and passed it like a baton to FedEx for same-day delivery to my in-law's house. Cost $480. And yes, I shopped around. Most carriers I reached couldn't even get a package from Washington to Chicago in the dwindling hours left before my departure. I later read, though never verified, that American Airlines had boarded international flights without passports after extended vetting at the airport, a risk I didn't want to take for such a short trip. My stress didn't fully dissolve until a courier handed me the envelope at 9 p.m. on my in-law's porch. He did a double take when I looked skyward and said, "Thanks, Mom." Well, what do you do while you can't travel? Prepare for when you can. And this is written by Lisa Weistick, and the editors add that her article was dialed in after a lost phone. I've long believed each day that ends with me in possession of my keys, phone, and wallet is a victory. Once I nearly missed that victory. Well, a few times, admittedly. But 6 other times, yes, 6, ended with someone finding my credit card and alerting me through Facebook. Such are the advantages of having an uncommon name. I was heading to JFK Airport in Queens to catch a morning flight to San Francisco. I arrived with minutes to spare, per usual, reached into my bag for my identification, and a groundswell of dread surged through every nerve ending. My phone was AWOL. I approached the most relaxed person I spotted, who was rattled by my panic, but was kind enough to let me use her phone to call my own. The young woman who answered had found it on her way to work at the Jamaica Center train station, where airport-bound passengers get off. 2 key things to know. To say Jamaica Center is busy is a gross understatement. Also, she worked at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in Manhattan, about 17 miles away as the crow flies. Translation, 95 minutes by train and foot. This is the part where I almost hugged the JetBlue agent, who switched my 9 a.m. ticket to a 9 p.m. ticket, and at no cost because I'd had arrived at the airport so close to boarding, he said. Also, tears helped. I recall the next sequence of events in time elapse. I used another Samaritan's phone to notify my blessed phone finder I was on my way. I darted, heavy bag in hand, or in tow, rather, to the monorail to the train. My apartment, joyfully, is en route to Manhattan, so I dropped off my bag, grabbed a bottle of bourbon, got to Sloan Kettering to exchange the whiskey for my phone, elicited applause from the security guards, and relished a relaxing day at home before my 9 p.m. flight. Biggest victory ever. Okay, then there's no time for island time. This is written by Carol Sotilli. She writes, I put on my best happy face when my presence was requested on a Carnival cruise to the Caribbean. But as a long-time traveler, I had to draw the line at canned shore excursions. No way would my husband and I swim with sad captive dolphins or drink watered-down umbrella drinks on an overcrowded beach. Instead, I devoted hours to researching the perfect outings. The pinnacle would be visiting a nature reserve on Cay Caulker, a small island off the coast of Belize. I visualized a few hours of isolated bliss, hiking through bird-rich forest far from the crowded cruise ship. The fantasy started going sideways when I noticed clocks along the waterfront at 8 a.m. when my watch said 9. At the ferry ticket counter, the clerk shook her head, saying, "Cruises don't usually change clocks to Caribbean time." How did I not know that? Belize is in the central time zone, while Florida is in the eastern time zone. Thankfully, we weren't in daylight saving time. It would have been 2 hours earlier, as Belize stays on standard time. But we could still do this. We could sit in the hot ferry terminal for 75 minutes and get to Cay Caulker, take a short hike, and forego lunch. 30 minutes late, we took off on the cheek-to-jowl ferry, more crowded than the Lido deck at high noon, or Lido deck. At one point, a tiny paw poked its way out the backpack next to me and grabbed my hand. "Don't worry," the owner told me, "it's just my pet Cotamundi." Well, the trip was billed as a 45-minute ride. 90 minutes later, after several unadvertised stops, we arrived, stared at the return schedule, and realized we had time for maybe a 20-minute stroll. But I can say I've been to Cape Cocker, and I did get to shake paws with a Cotamundi. Then we have The Affordable Rental Comes at a Price story by Christopher Elliott. The apartment in Ottawa, one of the stops on a cross-country road trip through Canada, looked perfect online. It was close to Ottawa's Parliament buildings and the Byward Market, and above all, it was affordable. It had a retro vibe in a kind of restoration hardware way, and the amenities seemed to check out. For us, the most important one was a wireless internet so the kids could do their schoolwork. I didn't notice the absence of a dishwasher, air conditioner, or elevator in the property description, and after hauling a month's worth of groceries and luggage up four flights of stairs in the midsummer heat, I began to wonder whether I'd made a mistake with this too-good-to-be-true rental. But once I entered the tiny apartment, I knew it. The rental smelled of stale cigarettes, mold, and bacon, and looked as if it had been abandoned months ago. A thin film of dust coated the shelves and tables. The interior was oppressively hot, and opening the windows made no difference. In the dishwasherless kitchen, I noticed a dark red stain on the counter. It looked as if an animal had been ritually slaughtered on it. Then there was a scream from the bedroom. "Daddy!" my 9-year-old daughter cried. "There's a spider in the bed!" Not just a spider, but several spiders and a web or two, and more on the windowsill, and dead flies. We evacuated the rental and checked into a Holiday Inn. The owner quickly refunded our money, but I learned an essential lesson about screening vacation rentals. Now I read every listing carefully and look for a list of necessary amenities, which includes a dishwasher and, if you're above the fourth floor, an elevator. I check the neighborhood safety ratings, and when I see mid-century decor, I assume it's original, and I click on the next listing. Moving on now to the next writer's story, and that's called That Empty Feeling by Melanie D.G. Kaplan. The fuel light comes on, and I shift into survival mode. Slow down, breathe deep, turn the air conditioner off and radio down. I'm in the middle of Montana, God only knows how far from the nearest gas station. It's not the first time I find myself far from fuel, surprised by a low fuel light. It happened once in Wyoming. I called my dad, who I believe can fix anything from anywhere, and it happened in the mountains of Arizona at dusk. I panicked, imagining myself walking 20 miles in the dark with a beagle. When I drive across the country, I drink in the landscape and forget to look at the fuel gauge. I take a perverse pride in pushing through long stretches, often waiting until I see the light before I consider filling up. That's reasonable in the eastern half of the country, the land of turnpikes and truck stops. But in the west, where distances between exits are great, the speed limit may be 80 and the mountains show no pity in tapping your tank. Waiting for the indicator means playing with fire. In Montana, the GPS searches for my salvation, fore and aft. I follow its directions to a shuttered Sinclair station, last open, it appears, in the Jurassic period. Slow and steady, I keep driving, knowing from previous close calls that the tank will grant me at least 35 bonus miles after its warning. I've used 30. My heart hammers until the seat under the seatbelt. This time I'm certain I won't make it. When I pull into the gas station, I turn off the car and close my eyes. After refueling, I start the engine and watch the gas needle rise from the dead. I relax my foot on the accelerator and turn up the radio. Lesson unlearned. And our final one is The Picturesque Yaks Talking Back, written by Elizabeth Chang. It was June 2018, and we were coming down the Shika Mountain, a 14,500-foot peak in western China, whose top is draped with strings of Tibetan prayer flags. My husband, two 20-something kids, and I were touring Yunnan Province, where our younger daughter had just finished a semester abroad, and we were a bit giddy. The exhilaration of Shika's stunning views had been amplified by our slightly oxygen-deprived brains. As our tour guide drove us back toward town, we spotted yaks grazing in the green pastures, encircled by sharp gray peaks under loose cotton bowl clouds. So picturesque! Could we stop to take pictures, we clamored. The driver obliged, turning onto a rutted field road. The yaks were accommodating, too. The younger ones put on a delightful show of running around. Yaks are basically bigger, hairier cattle, and we'd been dining on their meat. Still, we were charmed. Suddenly, a Tibetan couple drove up on a motorcycle, yelling and gesticulating and demanding 500 yuan, then close to $100. For taking photos of yaks, we asked, astonished. Remember, oxygen deprivation. For being on their land, the couple said. There was a sign, they insisted. We hadn't seen one, we protested. Later, farther down the road, we'd passed the sign facing the other direction. Meanwhile, our driver seemed to think being shaken down for $100 at the edge of a yak pasture was as bizarre as we did. Then our younger daughter started arguing with the couple in such rapid and intense Mandarin that her father and I were stunned into silence. Wow, she really had progressed in her language skills, we thought admiringly. This semester abroad was absolutely worth it. We were enjoying watching her so much that it wasn't until the man started wagging his finger threateningly in her face that I shook myself out of my daze and gave the couple about $20. Hopefully, we'll never again neglect to consider property rights, but that memory of our daughter speaking Chinese so freely and confidently lives in my mind even more vividly than the image of those iconic shaggy yaks. Oh, me. Travel blunders can become lessons learned on the road. Travel writer Andrea Socks is going to illustrate this in her article, A Newbie RV Rental Learns from Her Mistakes, and So Can You. Now, this appeared in the August 21st, 2020 issue of the Washington Post. For my first ever night in an RV rental, I imagined unfolding in a camp chair and eating dinner straight from the cast-iron skillet under a constellation of Edison lights. I would raise a beer, a cold beer, at my neighbors, who would reply with an air clink. When it was time for bed, I would curl up in the cocoon-like cabin, safe from the elements lurking outside the vehicle. Raccoons, stink bugs, and the coronavirus. In reality, I spent that July evening at a Virginia campground, watching the owner spray Febreze around the Winnebago in an attempt to mask the smell of waste that had spewed out of the sewage hose. Before the dumping demo, he had assured us that the waste tank was empty. Our noses knew otherwise. After the owner departed, leaving us alone in the RV, my friend and I stayed up late scooping up dead bugs and fiddling with the air conditioning, which was blowing subtropical air. At 3 a.m., we finally rested our weary heads on the mattress. The owners had neglected to inform us the RV didn't come with pillows. Your experience is going to be heavily dependent on who the owner is and the ins and outs of the vehicle, said Monica Garacci, an RV Industry Association spokeswoman. The onus is on the renter to educate themselves beforehand, she added. My inaugural outing in an RV wasn't an outright catastrophe. No humans, myself included, woodland creatures, or traffic cones were harmed, nor was the 24-foot motorhome I had rented through Outdoorsy, a peer-to-peer site founded in 2014. But the vacation was a bust. The morning after the drop-off, I discovered that the registration had expired in June, and the engine check light was on. For safety and legal reasons, I had to abandon the vehicle and my RV reverie, for now, but not forever. In response to my debacle, Outdoorsy co-founder Jen Young said, "We wish we could say 100% of renters report a positive trip experience, but that's not the real world. The real world is the one we're operating in, where we take the subpar experiences with the good ones and learn what improvements need to be made." She added that next month all owners will receive the Outdoorsy Owner's Handbook, which covers best practices and protocols. 2020 has been the summer of RV love, and by all accounts, it could be the endless summer of RV love. Recreational vehicles allow travelers to roam in a self-sufficient bubble, the preferred mode of exploration these days. RVing is the way to travel if you want to control your environment, Garacci said. We are seeing a second wave of people renting. Planning an RV trip? Well, here's what you need to know before you go. If you have driven a moving truck or a car with a rooftop tent, congrats, you're still an RV newbie. RVs typically contain the Holy Trinity of kitchen, bathroom, and bed, but the label is not a slight. It's a sign of the times. Outdoorsy said first-time customers accounted for more than 93% of its reservations in May and June. RV Share, another Airbnb-esque site, said 80% of its summer bookings were made by new users. While the new patrons might not be new drivers, the people snapping up RVs could be first-time renters, a burgeoning category of travel. Outdoorsy saw bookings soar in June with a 400% increase from the same time last year. RV Share said rentals for Labor Day weekend are up 95%. We love to see people come back, relaxed and looking 20 years younger, said Marisol Hill, who rents 6 RVs on the pier sites and through her San Bernardino, California-based company, Adventure RV. While my Winnebago adventure did not reverse the aging clock, I wasn't going to give up on the quest. To better prepare for my second attempt, I sought advice from RV experts, including the industry's National Association, the biggest rental platforms, and longtime owners. They provided tips on all aspects of RVing, from selecting the vehicle to planning the itinerary. Not one mentioned keeping a bottle of deodorizer in my holster. Choosing your vehicle. The sheer quantity of RVs in the rental market will make your head spin. RV Share, which was founded in 2013, lists more than 100,000 vehicles in 50 states. Outdoorsy claims twice as many in 14 countries. The first decision you must make is trailer or motorhome. For the trailer, you will need a car or truck capable of towing the weight of several baby elephants. In addition, it is not safe or legal in most states to ride in the attachment, so your family will have to cram into the less exciting vehicle of the two. On the plus side, you will have a comparatively pint-sized vehicle for tooling around your destination. Motorhomes are self-contained, and passengers can take full advantage of its amenities while on the road. Nap on the bed, raid the fridge, use the bathroom. Just make sure you're buckled up while moving. If you choose a motorhome, the next step is picking the type. Now, Class A vehicles sometimes resemble a rock star's tour bus in size and flash. Class B motorhomes, or van campers, are pipsqueaks by comparison. They max out at 22 feet and come with a kitchen and sleeping quarters, but not always a bathroom. For first-timers, Garachi recommends Class C, a happy medium between A and B. Vehicles in this category run 21 to 35 feet in length and often have a cab with an overhead compartment for sleeping or storage. Mark Ferguson, a North Carolinian who lists his 22-foot trailer in Outdoorsy, said a common mistake newbies make is trying to rent something bigger than their experience or vehicle can handle. Freddie Heller, a Richmond-based driving instructor with RV basic training, recommends a rig smaller than 30 feet. To rent an RV, peruse the listings on the peer-to-peer platforms. Use the filters, pet-friendly, air conditioner, washer-dryer, etc., to winnow down your options. Many owners post on Outdoorsy and RV Share, but prices may vary, so comparison shop. Dealerships and rental companies such as Cruise America and El Monte also rent vehicles. The more traditional businesses could have newer models and a smaller inventory than a rental by owner sites. However, they typically offer a more uniform level of quality and support. And on this issue, Outdoorsy's Young told me, one of the challenges for us is standardization. Hill urges renters to go thoroughly read the descriptions of the vehicles, take note of the number of beds and amenities, as well as what is included. For example, she provides a Keurig coffee maker, toaster, pots and pans, utensils, and camping chairs. Because of the pandemic, many owners are pulling the bedding down to the pillows and blankets. Also, familiarize yourself with additional costs, such as the charge for exceeding the cap on mileage, typically 100 miles, and generator usage, 4 hours. Some owners will deliver the vehicle to your campground and dump your tanks for an extra fee. Most important, pay attention to the reviews and seek out owners with high star ratings and several rentals under their belts. A communicative owner with an intimate knowledge of his or her vehicle is as important as a kitted out rig. You have to know your equipment so you can explain it to your guest, Hill said. Once you find a match, reach out to the owner and ask away. Height, length, and miles per gallon of the vehicle, pickup and drop off times, last service date, recommended insurance policy, deposit amount, name of the vehicle. I call her Lady Skipper, said Christy Pickler, who has rented her 27-foot Sunseeker more than a dozen times since last July. She adds, she'll take care of you. Getting to know your RV. Every rental will include a walkthrough and should incorporate a test drive. This is your moment to peek behind every door, flip every switch, and lift every cover. Be nosy and inquisitive. Pay attention to the owner explaining how to use everything, Ferguson said, and make sure they walk you through setting up the camper, placing the stabilizers, and operating the slides and water and power hookups. Don't hesitate to ask any questions. Neither of you wants to guess and damage something on the road. From my rental, I was eagerly looking forward to this step, since I had never driven a vehicle as intricate as a Winnebago. As soon as the owner arrived at the RV resort, he showed me around the vehicle, following a checklist from Outdoorsy. However, he skipped to the test drive, maybe because I looked like an ace driver, or maybe because he pulled up during quiet hours, which start at 10 p.m. Yet even the tour was insufficient. When I asked how the stove worked, he shrugged his shoulders and told me we ate sandwiches. When I commented on the tilt of the RV, he never suggested using leveling blocks to correct the incline. When I inquired about a black box under the steering wheel, he stared at the object as if it had magically appeared. There's definitely a learning curve if you're new to RV life, Garacci told me, when I confessed my lack of knowledge, which didn't improve after the walkthrough, due to the research on the front end. I realized that to ask informed questions and grasp the answers, I should have been better prepared. So I binged on YouTube videos directed at newbies. I watched Mark and Tricia Leach of Keep Your Daydream, Ray and Jason Miller, the getaway couple, and Stacy and Phil Farley of You, Me, and the RV. I took notes and rewound a lot. I was growing more confident when Pickler invited me over to observe a walkthrough on the Lady Skipper. On a Thursday evening in Springfield, Virginia, I joined a mom, dad, and two sons inside the RV. 10 eyes peered into the bathroom. We're all family here, Pickler said. We talk about poop. Over the hour, she went over every inch of the vehicle, inside and out. She explained the generator, propane tank, and air conditioning, demonstrated how to fold up the bed like a taco, flush the toilet, and secure the latches on the windows and door. She mock-filled the water tank and pretend dumped the waste tank, which, thankfully, was really empty. Pickler encouraged the family to record the proceedings, acknowledging she was throwing a lot of information at him. For the test drive, Pickler instructed the mom to back out of the spot and drive through the lot, an obstacle course of parked cars and children chasing runaway balls. She merged into the main road and took several left and right turns. "How am I doing space-wise?" she asked Pickler from the right lane. "Go further out," she said. "Slow way down and cut hard." Lady Skipper kissed the curb, but it was only a little peck. And in planning your itinerary with an RV, always know where you're sleeping. But where you park, or more romantically, keep house, is another question. The experts urge newbies to pick an RV site that is move-in ready with a full hookup and pull-through spot versus backing in. When you have more experience, you can try dry camping or boondocking, but for now, don't cut the cord. Dry camping is not the optimal experience for your first time, Hill said. You're using the reserves. So there's something to learn if you're thinking about going on the RV adventure of your life. And therefore, keep that information in mind. And with all that, we've run out of time for today's episode of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed your journey and you'll listen next time. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions may be directed to 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.